My friends, I'd like to share some insights of the Prophet Muhammad, 6th century, that could be of help to us in these troubled times, both individually and collectively. So first, some words about the Prophet. He was born in 570 CE, after birth of Christ, an orphan. And he was shuttled from household to household. And he was really very despairing, very hurt about the injustices of his time, particularly the oppression of women and slaves. And so from time to time, he would go into the mountains and just be in silence, meditate. And once when he was 40 years old, he encountered during a vigil, a retreat in the middle of the night or early morning, an encounter with Angel Gabriel, and the first verses of the Quran were revealed, and he became a prophet. And so he became even more outspoken against the injustices, the oppression of the marginalized. And for this, he was threatened, harassed, persecuted, and attempts made on his life. Things became so difficult that he had to make a shift, a move, a migration from Mecca to Medina in the year 622 CE. And he had just 10 more years to live. But in those short 10 years, he was able to consolidate the warring tribes and lay the foundation for an Islamic civilization. So significant is that shift, what is called the Hijra in 622 CE, that is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. So what would Prophet Muhammad say is one overarching divine attribute we need for fulfillment in our lives, both individually and collectively? In fact, he said it very often. The entire wisdom of Islam can be distilled into one divine attribute, compassion. Compassion for self and compassion for others. You've probably heard many times that the best way to describe the power, the majesty of this divine attribute is by exploring this element in nature of water. There is nothing as soft and yielding as water is, yet for overcoming the hardest, there's nothing as powerful as water is. It can wash away continents. And also, wherever water falls, life flourishes. Meaning, the person who is gentle, compassionate, merciful, is possessed of raw, authentic strength, and is also life-bestowing, life-affirming. So, to explain what does it mean to be compassionate with self, I love the words of Carl Jung, who studied many Eastern traditions. And I remember his statement by heart. He said that I feed the hungry, forgive an insult, and love my enemy. These are great virtues. But what if I should discover that the poorest of beggars and the most impudent of offenders are all within me, and that I stand in need of the alms of my own kindness, that I myself am the enemy who must be loved? What then? And to really understand what does it mean to be compassionate with others, I love the words of that 15th, 16th century Indian mystic Kabir, who says, you know, in dealing with somebody who is adversarial, protect yourself. Don't allow yourself to be abused. But I beg you, as you take the right action, do not keep this person's essence out of your heart. This person's essence is one's divine spark, Christ nature, Buddha nature, Elohim nature, Allah nature, and just making this discernment, this distinction between behavior and being has the power to shift heaven and earth. Which is why when Prophet Muhammad was asked always to curse wrongdoers, he would always say, but I have been sent as a mercy for others. And I love his other saying that if kindness or compassion was a thing of the created world, there is nothing in the world that could be more beautiful than this. So please be with this for a few moments. Am I compassionate with myself and with others? Okay, the Prophet Muhammad was very insistent on saying, there is no shortcut. If we want peace, harmony, justice in our own lives, in our society, we simply have to do the inner inconvenient work. And there's a word which is associated with that, which is for Westerners very frightening. For someone like me who knows the meaning of it, it's very sacred. The word is jihad. Jihad simply means effort, exertion, a struggle. You see, most people have misheard or heard the abuse of the word jihad with regard to only one portion of the meaning of this word, which is about fighting for justice. There's a verse in the Quran that says, fight in the way of God those who fight you, but begin not hostilities, for God loves not the aggressor. But the greater meaning of jihad is the struggle, the work required to transform the ego and open up the heart. So once after a battle, and remember, the Islamic community in Medina was very small, always being attacked. Once returning from a battle, he gathered his followers and told them, we have come from the lesser jihad. Let us now engage in the greater jihad. Greater jihad? What is that? He said, well, the real enemy is between the ribs. We have to do this work of transforming our ego from a commanding master into a personal assistant and open up the heart so we can have more of an inner spaciousness. And of course, not everybody followed that because it is very difficult work. So just briefly, I love some sentences about the fact that it is critical as we transform the ego to purify ourselves, to cleanse our heart. The Prophet said, you know, for every rust, there is a polish. And the polish for the rust of the heart is remembrance of God, meaning cleanse your heart with the solvent of divine attributes, like patience, love, truthfulness. And Rumi cautions, as he says, you know, if you get irritated by every rub, how will the mirror of your heart ever be polished? The Prophet was very keen to tell us, unless we do this work of purification, we can never really be authentically just, equitable. You know, the Quran says, be just. This is closest to being God-conscious. The Prophet Muhammad said, an hour of justice is far better than a year of worship. So if we don't do this inner work, then in fighting injustice, we might ourselves become unjust. In fighting extremism, we ourselves might become extreme. This is very difficult work. So even prophets have to be cautioned. So in the Quran, the Prophet Muhammad is berated because as he's talking to a very pompous tribal chieftain to enter into a military treaty because that's the way that the community would survive, he was interrupted by a very sincere old blind man, and the Prophet ignored him. And that night, a revelation came to the Prophet, and God said, you know, the one who came to you with an inner awe, you disregarded. The person But the person who considered himself self-sufficient, pompous, to him you paid attention. This should not be so. So the point here is, this work is difficult. That's why it's wonderful to have a community where we can support one another in doing this work. So just be with that again for a few moments. So now something about the fact that suffering is inevitable. It's a world of opposites. And the Prophet Muhammad, he suffered a lot in his life. Some say that probably there was no person on earth who has attended more funerals than the Prophet Muhammad. Anyhow, at one point he felt very abandoned by God. And then a revelation came from God saying that, you know, please know your sustainer has not forgotten you. And gave some pieces of advice that even in your deepest moment of desperation, number one, continue your acts of service according to your capacity. And number two, don't give up in these difficult times on your spiritual practices. Rumi says, be sure, particularly in these times, to be in attendance at the divine court. And this will ease your suffering and magically open many doors. Which is why, you know, many sages, observing the conduct of the Prophet Muhammad during the time of his suffering, which was quite often, they have come up with these insights. For example, one is, don't run towards pain and suffering because it has, you know, some deep lessons. Don't run towards pain and suffering. Just don't run away from it when it happens. And number two, a wonderful prayer is, oh God, save me from its harm, but please do not deprive me of its good in relationship to suffering. And also, you're asked to really be very mindful that in times of suffering and desperation, some opportunities arise, some invitations for change. You know, I talked about the fact that the Prophet Muhammad, he was in a very difficult situation, persecuted, threatened, even attempts on his life. And then there came an invitation for him to become the leader of a tribe in Medina. And that's when Prophet Muhammad made that migration, as I said, in 622. And then his entire fortunes changed. And that's called the Hijra. And we're being asked to become aware of the Hijra moments in our life. Some slight changes that could change the entire destiny of our life. May I be aware of that? In the Quran, the most used word is Allah, Allah, Allah. The second most used word is ilm, or knowledge. There's a verse or a saying of the Prophet Muhammad I like very much. The Prophet Muhammad said, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. So knowledge is highly valued in the Quran, and also, of course, by the Prophet. But the Prophet Muhammad was very keen to say that, of course, it is very critical you listen to and learn from pundits and experts, from authorities. But he would say, please don't be slavishly dependent on outside authorities. And his famous words were, no matter what they say, first, always consult your heart. And he would repeat it, consult your heart. Someone said to the Prophet Muhammad, don't we need priests? because the Prophet Muhammad was emphatic that between humanity and God, there should be no intermediary. He was against any ordination of priests. It doesn't mean that Muslims have followed that, but he was against it. And he would say, the only priest you ever need is awareness of your death. If you really realize at a heart level that you are going to die anytime, your life priorities by themselves begin to rearrange themselves. So just be with that. Am I in touch with my inner teacher? Okay, next one is, of course we need faith. Faith in God, faith in the grace of God, trust in God. But I love this story where the prophet emphasized that, you know, for help from God, for grace from God, we have to do our part. So the Bedouin with his camel, if you remember the story, on the way to the mosque, asked the Prophet Muhammad, should I just trust in God? Or should I tie the camel to the post? And the Prophet Muhammad said, first, tie the camel to the post, then trust in God. And Muslims are asked to meditate on that. Okay, something very important that the Prophet emphasized, the critical need to engage in righteous deeds. Because the Quran says, what takes you to heaven is not your gender, not your religion, it is the record of your righteous deeds, what Rumi calls being a lamp, a lifeboat, or a ladder to others, to God's creation. And I love the words of Prophet Muhammad, who said, really, it is about cultivating, developing an attitude of service. His words were, do good deeds according to your capacity. God never tires of giving rewards unless you tire of doing good deeds. The good deeds most loved by God are the ones that are done regularly, no matter how small they are. And the Prophet Muhammad also emphasized that a critical part of righteous deeds is radical service. You know, the verse in the Quran, which the Prophet Muhammad emphasized, is free a slave from bondage. This is meant both literally and metaphorically. So the Prophet Muhammad, he modeled this, you know, he adopted a slave and raised him as his son. He chose an African slave, Bilal, to be the first Muslim to give the call to prayer. You see, modern progressive Muslims say, if you want to overcome homelessness in our society, which is rampant, at the grassroots level, we have to be engaged, participate, and make some sacrifices. You know, the Prophet Muhammad was even radical in his marriages. He was married for 25 years to Khadija, who was 15 years his senior in age. Unconventional in the 7th century, 6th century, unconventional even today. And what was very strange to people at that time in the 7th century Arabia was that he was monogamous. He was married to one woman for 25 years till she died. And after she died, he married, we don't know exactly how many, some say 8 times. But what is very critical to note is, except for one woman, a young girl named Aisha, he married her when she reached puberty at 14. And she was the daughter of his best friend, Abu Bakr, who became the first caliph After the Prophet Muhammad died, and Abu Bakr was always saying, if you love me so much, let's join our families together. And Muhammad would say, but she's too young. And Abu Bakr would say, but she will grow up. So, you know, he eventually married Aisha. But all his other wives, besides Aisha, were either slaves, widows, or divorcees, all considered discards. And Prophet Muhammad was expressing that, if I as a prophet marry these people who you scorn, discard, please know this is wrong. And also, and this is not very well known, Prophet Muhammad married two women who were Jews and one woman who was a Christian. And he asked them not to change their religion because they were people of the book. The Prophet Muhammad had a very close connection with nature. And this is something very critical for our times. He would say, if you are planting a sapling, and he encouraged people to plant saplings, he said, even if you hear that the next hour is the end of the world, the day of judgment is coming, don't stop planting. Keep on planting that sapling. And his famous words are, the earth, the planet earth, is like your mother. Honor her. Protect her. Which is why for Islamic mystics, nature is the holiest of the holy books. And I love how sages use nature to counter the, for example, the insights of some Islamic extremists who would say that singing is forbidden. And the sages say, well, look at nature. If singing was forbidden, wouldn't God forbid the birds from chirping? Or just to explain, for example, some sages say, you know, harsh and angry words are far less productive than soft and gentle words. And the poetry is, exalt and raise your words, not your voice. It is rain that grows flowers, not thunder. And as I come to an end, critical that we build community. This was the main goal of the Prophet Muhammad. And he asked the people who came with him from Mecca when they migrated to Medina, the emigrants, he joined them with the people in Medina who were called helpers. And he said, you must create a model of creating these circles of friendship where you help one another to evolve in the fullness of your being and you collaborate in projects of mutual interest. And based on that, Islamic sages have come up with some gateways for creating authentic community. Number one, it has to be members who have love for you and you have affection for them. The first gateway is love. The second gateway is trust. Without trust, there's no vulnerability. Without vulnerability, there's no community. And the third one is aspiration for truth. It is said, even prophets sought companions. I love the words of Rumi, a wall standing alone is useless. Add to it other walls, it can support a roof, even a granary. Only when ink joins with a pen, can the blank paper say something. Let me really come to an end now. Among many practices, there's one practice just of, I'm talking about spiritual practices, being silent. When the Prophet Muhammad was meditating in the cave in Mecca, an angel Gabriel appeared. The Quran says, it is in silence, in meditation, that angels and the spirit descend. These are very holy moments. Which is why Rumi says, silence is not the absence of sound. It is the absence of the little self. And he says, silence is the language of God. Everything else is a poor translation. So the practice of silence, the practice of gratitude. The Quran says, everything which dwells upon the earth extols the limitless glory of God. When we praise God and thank God, God doesn't become holy, we become holy. And of course, maybe just one more, repeating a mantra, a sacred mantra. The Prophet Muhammad said, keep your tongue forever moistened with the name of Allah. Why would this work? If you remember the metaphor we always talk about, a vat or a pot of dye, D-Y-E, color. Take a cloth, dip it into the vat of dye. It has a beautiful color, but then it fades away over time. But what happens if you dip it in the vat of dye again and again and again and again? There comes a time it becomes color fast, permanent. That sacred mantra begins to color us, becomes permanent. Ask yourself, what spiritual practices are you doing? And with that, my friends, let's bring this to a close. Thank you very much.